This is Mark Movsesian. I'm the co-director of the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's, and I'm joined one more time by my friend and colleague, the center's other co-director, Mark DiGirolami, for an episode of Legal Spirits, our podcast series on cases and issues in law and religion. You can find past episodes archived at Apple iTunes and also on our webpage, lawandreligionforum, that's one word, .org. Well, Mark, how are things for you up in Westchester?
Good. Everything is just fine. I'm just returned from teaching our Introduction to Law course in person at St. John's, a course that both of us are teaching, but I'm doing it at school. And so far, so good. No issues to report, and things seem to be going pretty smoothly.
Yeah, same with me, Mark. I'm teaching online. I'm also doing the Introduction to Law class, and things are going smoothly for us, too. Actually, we both talk about intro to law, and our episode today is going to actually be targeted towards that course. So we're going to depart, listeners, from our usual format. This episode isn't going to be about a current case or controversy. Actually, it's about a much older controversy, a controversy that's about 500 years old. Or rather, I guess we'd say it's about a film about that controversy. We're going to talk in this episode about A Man for All Seasons from 1966, which is the film version of Robert Bolt's very famous play about Sir Thomas More. Unlike some of our other episodes, this podcast is directed specifically at law students and even more specifically at our 1Ls at St. John's, who, as we've said, are completing their Introduction to Law class.
So the story of St. Thomas More has its own interest, of course, but it's also of special interest to students coming to St. John's. The church at St. John's is dedicated to More, and students can see a statue of More if they visit the church. And beyond that, More is one of the patron saints of lawyers in the Catholic Church, together with other saints like St. Ives and others still. So this is another reason for future lawyers who are attending St. John's to get to know a little bit about More as they're introduced to the law school, and whether they are themselves Catholic or not, if they subscribe to some other faith or to no faith, it's important for students to know about, to learn about the traditions of the school that they attend, and More is certainly a big part of that at St. John's.
Yes, and that's why, Mark, you and I have assigned A Man for All Seasons to our intro students. And this podcast is part of the curriculum for that class, although we hope it will be interesting to other students and listeners as well. In fact, we're confident that it will be. The film recounts one of the most famous stories in English history, the conflict between King Henry VIII and one of his ministers, Sir Thomas More, for Catholics, as Mark points out, St. Thomas More, in the 16th century. And this is an episode from the English Reformation, the break with Rome. Now, the dispute between Henry and Thomas was at bottom a religious one, a question of Christian theology. But in his play and the film on which the play is based, Bolt adapted that story to make more general points about law and conscience in the contemporary world. Our plan for this episode is the following. First, Mark and I will discuss the history on which the film is based, because although it's widely known, not everyone knows it. And we should say that the film is mostly faithful to this history. And then we'll discuss two aspects of the film that are relevant for law students and for lawyers today. First, we'll talk about how far lawyers should go in submerging their own judgment to serve the wishes of their clients. As we'll see in the film, Henry wants Thomas's help in crafting legal justifications for his divorce and for his break with Rome. But Thomas can't go along because Thomas thinks the king's legal arguments are wholly implausible. And that's an issue that can face lawyers today as well, even if the stakes are not so high, and even if the lawyers are not senior government officials like Thomas.
So we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about what, if anything, various contemporary rules of professional responsibility have to say about that. The so-called model rules of professional conduct, as those have been adapted in almost all jurisdictions, there are specific provisions that deal with this question, and we'll see the extent to which those are helpful or not in resolving some of these disputes.
Okay, and then the second thing we'll talk about is one of the main themes in the film is Thomas's faith in the rule of law. As we'll see throughout, Thomas More believes that if he follows the letter of the law, he'll be safe. He thinks, and he's right about this as a legal matter, that the law allows him to remain silent and therefore beyond punishment. And in this, he makes two mistakes. First, he trusts that people in power will fairly enforce the law. And second, he fails to understand that he lives in a totalitarian state that will not allow dissenters to remain silent, but force them to speak. And we should say that Bolt is writing this at the height of the Cold War, and he certainly has totalitarian societies in mind. Right, Mark?
Yeah, that's true. But we're also going to talk a little bit about whether these issues remain relevant today, and even when one doesn't live in a totalitarian state or in a state such as the one that Moore was living in. Our view, I think, is going to be that they can still be quite relevant and they can still be important, even though, as you said before, the issues are not quite as acute.
Yeah, they're perennial problems, I think. Okay, so let's talk about the history. So at the time the film takes place, Henry, who's played by Robert Shaw, is a young, athletic, immensely talented and learned man, and in his way, a serious Catholic. In fact, the Pope had given Henry the title Defender of the Faith for Henry's book, Defending the Sacraments and the Vatican, which is a title that British monarchs continue to use today. Henry, as Moore recognizes, and also Moore's nemesis, Cromwell, recognizes, is in his way a man of conscience. He desperately wants to believe that what he is doing is right and legal. So Henry's married to Queen Catherine, his brother's widow, whom we never see in the film. Now, technically, the marriage to the widow of one's brother was illegal. It was a kind of incest. But the Pope had granted Henry a special dispensation to marry Catherine for state reasons. As it turned out, Catherine couldn't bear Henry a son, which was a major problem, because no son meant no prince, and no prince could mean the end of the Tudor dynasty. So, Mark, what happens?
So Henry became convinced that he now can't father a son with Catherine because he's cursed by this incestuous marriage. So he goes the other way. He sought the dispensation. He had obtained it. And now that it didn't result in what he wanted, he changed his mind. So now he seeks an annulment of the marriage, working through Cardinal Wolsey, played in the film by Orson Welles, who serves as Henry's lawyer with the Vatican. And this time the Pope refuses to grant the annulment. And so this is the reason that Wolsey dies disgraced. And Henry assumes that Wolsey must have been a traitor. He must have been working surreptitiously against Henry while pretending to represent him. And I should add that there's a wonderful biography by Peter Ackroyd that I read a long time ago. And as we were preparing for this podcast, I was sort of leafing through it. And one interesting thing is one of the first places that Henry goes, other than to these legal sources like Wolsey, is to the Academy. So he knows that if he goes to the Academy, sort of the equivalent of professors, he's going to get the answer that he wants. And in fact, he does get the answer that he wants in the form of asseverations by people like Thomas Cranmer and others who were important academics of the period, that in fact, he has the better of the argument with respect to whether this, this annulment should be given, whether the marriage was valid at all from the first place, and so on.
Well, it wouldn't be the first time, I guess. It wouldn't be the first time that university faculty decide to be useful to the state. I guess we can say that.
So when he can't get an annulment, he breaks from Rome and he establishes the Church of England, and he establishes himself as the head of the Church of England on earth. The Church of England now, of course, grants Henry a divorce and allows him to marry Anne Boleyn.
Go ahead, Mark.
So then Parliament requires subjects to take an oath that recognize Henry's marriage to Anne and his position and Henry's position as supreme head on earth of the church. And by this point, of course, Sir Thomas, who was at one point actually mixed up with some of the academics that I mentioned, himself a teacher and so on, is serving as Lord Chancellor.
Well, we should say that Thomas More was himself a quite famous academic, and he is still read today. Utopia is still being read today, one of his great works. So yes, he was very much a part of the academic world, which is one reason why Henry is so eager to have More sign up for this new principle that Henry is the head of the church. But Thomas won't do that. And he won't do that because the oath denies papal supremacy over the church, which for Thomas was a non-negotiable issue. Now, Thomas was a great humanist. He was not a fundamentalist, but he was a very strict Catholic, and especially on this point, the point of papal supremacy. So this puts Thomas in a difficult position. He is the Lord Chancellor. He is the head of the equity courts in Britain. He's one of Henry's chief legal advisor. So it's quite embarrassing for Henry that his Lord Chancellor won't sign the oath. Thomas says, okay, tell you what, I will resign. I'll resign and stay silent, and that should end the problem. However, Thomas was sufficiently high profile, and as we said, sufficiently well known in the university world across Europe, and had been a statesman, had been an ambassador, was a famous man, that Thomas's silence was embarrassing for Henry. Also, and the film gets this very well, Henry was personally hurt by this because, of course, he had promoted Thomas More and made his career, and clearly felt that Thomas owed him something and really shouldn't be opposing him like this. So eventually, Henry has Thomas tried for treason and convicted on phony evidence, perjury by Thomas's former pupil, Sir Richard Rich. And by the way, we should say that Orson Welles is fantastic as Cardinal Wolsey. Robert Shaw is great as the king. Richard Rich is portrayed by John Hurt, who does just a great job as being kind of a smarmy guy. And my favorite, I don't know about you, Mark, my favorite portrayal in the film is actually Thomas Cromwell, who's portrayed by the great Australian actor Leo McKern, who is also Rumpole of the Bailey later. For me, he makes that whole film. I've seen this film so many times, and I really enjoy Cromwell.
Yeah, he's terrific. I agree with that. Cromwell is really excellent. And actually, even though he's the villain, of course, in subsequent renditions of this story, the one by Hilary Mantel, for example, he becomes the hero. It's a very different sort of rendition of the story than the one that we're talking about. But he is a very complicated and interesting character, I think, and portrayed very well in this movie.
Who also comes to a bad end himself. I mean, after the film, 5 years later, he himself is executed by Henry for treason. So it was not safe to get too close to Henry VIII. So Thomas is convicted. It's a very famous trial scene. He's convicted on the basis of testimony from Sir Richard Rich, who testifies that Thomas revealed his opposition to the king's supremacy through answers to a series of hypotheticals. And I tell our law students, it's a nice point to remember. You should watch out because your professor's classroom hypotheticals may not be as innocent as they seem.
Though hopefully less will turn on a wrong answer to them than turned on a wrong answer for Thomas More.
It's very rare for a student to be executed. I mean, it can happen, but it's not a usual thing. And Thomas, of course, is executed eventually in the Tower of London on July 6, 1535. Okay, so that's the history. Now, let's move on to these two points we want to make. And the first one is about lawyers and clients. And we should say, you know, Mark, we understand there are many themes in this film about religious liberty and conscience. And so we're directing this at law students. We don't mean to say these are the only or even the most important themes in the film, but they are important for our students. So the film portrays the attorney-client relationship between Thomas and Henry, I think, very well. And students should pay attention to that wonderful scene in Thomas More's garden when Henry pays Thomas a surprise visit for dinner in the early part of the play. Now, the background is that Henry has already asked Thomas whether he, Henry, has a legal right to divorce Catherine, and he has come for Thomas's answer. Now, Margaret, More's daughter, protests that the king's already had his answer. You know, Thomas has already said he doesn't agree with the legal basis for the divorce. And Norfolk, the Duke of Norfolk, responds he wants another answer. That is, the king wants another answer. Henry wants Thomas, his lawyer, to give him a legal opinion that Henry has the right, maybe even the duty, to divorce Catherine. But Thomas says he can't do so. He thinks the king's legal argument is specious, and he tells Henry that. And what's Henry's reaction? Henry is enraged. He shouts at him, "You are my chancellor." In other words, your conscience is your own business, but you're my lawyer and you're supposed to help me. Plus, Henry thinks and says, sort of, you know, "I'm the king. I made you who you are. Without me, you're a nobody. You're just a university professor. How dare you show such ingratitude and oppose me?" And Mark, this is something that lawyers occasionally have to face in our profession. The powerful client who wants something really badly and doesn't want to listen when his attorney tells him that the law doesn't allow him to do what he wants to do.
Yeah, that's right. Actually, the model rules, as I mentioned before, they contain a number of provisions that try to finesse this intractable problem. I should think the problem is it's not even occasional. It probably happens regularly that that a client has certain wishes of one kind or another, and a lawyer thinks that those wishes might be unwise or ill-advised or not worth pursuing. But you're probably right that rarely is it the case that the conflict really escalates to a kind of crisis, a moral crisis, in the way that it's certainly in the way that that the movie presents it. But so there are various provisions of the model rules that deal with this. And in particular, Rule 1.2 says that a lawyer shall abide by a client's decisions concerning the objectives of representation and shall consult with a client as to the means by which they are to be pursued.
So what does that mean, Mark? And how does that cash out?
Well, so the rule seems to contemplate a division in responsibility and authority between the ends or the objectives that the client has in mind, whatever it is that the client has retained ultimately the lawyer's services for, and the means or technical instruments that the lawyer can use to achieve them, and that the lawyer really in the main ought to defer to the client's chosen objectives or ends. And that the lawyer should confine his or her expertise to using whatever technical means will get to those ends. So this
okay,
is,
well,
I think,
that sounds pretty good for Henry.
Well, it does. I mean, this sounds like Thomas should perhaps have deferred had he been governed by the regime of the rules. Now, there are other rules that seem to take a somewhat different view. So Rule 2.1 says that, quote, "In representing a client, a lawyer shall exercise independent professional judgment and render candid advice. In rendering advice, a lawyer may refer not only to law, but to other considerations such as moral, economic, social, and political factors that may be relevant to the client's situation," close quote. So here, Mark, by contrast, the rules do seem to contemplate, in fact, in the first part of the rule, require that the lawyer has to make an independent judgment about what is right, what is correct in representing a client. And yet still, the injunction to refer to moral factors in rendering advice, you can notice the word is may, so it's permissive only. And interestingly enough, Mark, in prior iterations of the rules, the injunction was actually mandatory. A lawyer was required to refer to some of these moral and political factors in rendering advice, rendering counsel.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because my experience is it's much more difficult to tell a client that, you know, what you're doing is immoral than it is to say, well, look, the law just doesn't allow you to do it. I'm not going to call you a bad person, you know. So it's interesting that at one point the rule said the lawyer had to do that.
That is true.
And of course, the rules are, this is a very different kind of world we're living in, because I think the world of the 16th century, it would have been understood that, of course, we all want to do the Christian thing. So, of course, we're in a much more libertarian society now where we think the lawyer really doesn't have a basis for saying something is right or wrong, just what's legal. And of course, you know, Sir Thomas, his point was, what you're trying to do, Your Majesty, is not legal. Right. So now they have an impasse because the king says what I want to do is legal. And in fact, I have a duty to do it. It's my legal obligation to divorce my wife because it's an incestuous marriage. And Thomas More says, no, you don't. You have to wait for the Pope, and the Pope is not going to give you a dispensation. So now we have a real conflict. And I understand, Mark, that the rules now, in a situation like that, the lawyer might have a possibility of withdrawing representation in a case like that.
Yes, that's true. There is a rule governing so-called withdrawal from representation of clients. And that rule includes a number of both mandatory and permissive situations in which a lawyer may withdraw from representing a client. And one of the permissive withdrawal provisions deals with cases where, quote, the client insists upon taking action that the lawyer considers repugnant or with which the lawyer has a fundamental disagreement, close quote. So it seems to me, at least under the regime of the rules, Thomas would have a possible way out here. But even though there are cases where sometimes a lawyer can withdraw from representing a client where a moral impasse of the kind that you describe is reached, even under those circumstances, there are other considerations that can work to prevent this sort of withdrawal. One example would be if the case is far enough along, for example, let's say very close to trial, such that it would work a prejudice, a hardship on the client to switch lawyers at that point, then a judge might deny the request for permissive withdrawal, depending on whether suitable alternative counsel can be found and so on. So even then, it's permissive and it's not sure to work given the particular situations. But overall, I would say, you can see in sort of these different pronouncements going in different directions from the rule that it's not really clear that the rules resolve these kinds of issues conclusively. And it's even further from clear that they would really be a very much assistance to somebody in Thomas More's situation.
Well, and we should say that, you know, this kind of thing I'm sure happens all the time in government. There are president, the governors, various members of Congress and legislatures. Sometimes they really want something very badly and they don't like hearing that the lawyer, don't like hearing their lawyer who they think, you know, you're my guy, you're supposed to help me. They don't like hearing the lawyer say you can't do it. Now, Thomas thought, okay, look, I just can't do this and I will withdraw and they will leave me alone. I am not going to be the representative any longer. Which we should say was a serious thing for Thomas More to do. It meant he was back to being kind of a nobody. And in the film, he's willing to do that because this is his conscience. He won't go any further. And he thinks that will be the end of the story. But of course, I'm sure it wouldn't be the end of the story today necessarily. And it certainly wasn't the end of the story in Tudor England. Okay, let's move on then to this second point, because this leads into this idea that Thomas has, as long as I abide by the law, okay, I'll have to give up my position. I'm no longer going to be a powerful person. I'll have to dismiss my household servants. I'm going to be impoverished, but at least they'll leave me alone. They can't make me do what I don't want to do. As Bolt presents it, Thomas is a sort of classical liberal. He is committed to conscience, and also, as I've just said, he's committed to the rule of law. Now, Mark, you and I can discuss this. I think actually Peter Ackroyd discusses this in that book that you mentioned. This portrayal of More by Bolt really is a distortion and an anachronism. I mean, Thomas More was a Catholic martyr. His commitment was to the church. It wasn't to conscience or to the rule of law in the abstract. In fact, as Lord Chancellor, he had harshly persecuted Protestants and dissenters, which is something that Hilary Mantel mentions in her book.
Yeah, and I think that's right as a criticism of Bolt's portrayal, but you know, it may also be a broader criticism, it seems to me. So I think if we think about lawyers that are confronted with these kinds of dilemmas, even, of course, if they're not as extreme as Moore's situation, they're not going to be motivated by just a sort of abstract commitment to conscience as a kind of dry ideal. What they're going to be motivated by is their allegiance to some underlying principle, substantive moral principle that they will find important enough that they will risk, that they think it's worthwhile, if they do find themselves in this situation, to risk their relationship of representation with a client and to take a moral stand. But I'm dubious that would in the main be a moral stand just because of conscience itself. It's the underlying morality that would be the thing that would be motivating them. So perhaps there are analogies here.
Yeah, no, I think that's right, Mark. I think that, you know, people don't necessarily die for you know, procedural neutrality, which in some ways is kind of what Bolt presents more as dying for. Not entirely. It's also for liberty of conscience. But also, I think Moore is presented as sort of dying for the rule of law in the sense that we follow the procedures, even if we find the person who is being protected morally repugnant. So, and this says a lot, I think, about Bolt's belief in classical liberalism, even if not Thomas More's. And in this regard, there's a very famous discussion in the play between Thomas More and his son-in-law, Roper. It's very famous, quoted all the time. I think actually Robert Bork quoted it at one point in his famous book, The Tempting of America. So Roper tells Thomas that this guy, Richard Rich, is malevolent and is a spy and is going to bring down More and his family. And More says, well, I'm not going to arrest him because he hasn't violated the law. And Roper becomes very upset and says, so, you know, would you give the devil the protection of the law? If the devil were around, would you let him go free? And More's answer is very famous. He says, I'd give the devil the benefit of the law for my own safety's sake. And his point is that in our civil system, we protect the legal rights of even the most malevolent evil actors for our own protection, because we understand that procedural neutrality protects not only the devil, not only people like Sir Richard, but also people like us. We abide by the rules so that the state cannot eventually turn on us. You see, More is relying on the law to protect him, and he does so right until the end. He keeps telling everybody, as long as I abide by the letter of the law, as long as I stay within the bounds of the law, I am going to be safe. And his position is, there is no law against remaining silent. And anyway, under traditional legal principles, silence implies consent. Silence implies consent. So he says to everybody, his wife, he tells his daughter, he tells Roper, if I just remain silent, as a legal matter, I will be taken to have understood that I have consented to the divorce. And he says, I'm willing to let people think that, right? Because that is my legal right.
Is that true, by the way, Mark, in, for example, contract law, that qui tacit consentire, like whoever who is silent is seen to consent or not?
Not entirely in contract law, no. I assume that Sir Thomas was speaking about some other sort of principles. In contract law, actually, silence by itself is not considered assent to an offer. So you cannot be forced into a contract by your silence. In some circumstances you can, but it's not a general principle actually, but that would have ruined the play, Mark. So I guess, you know.
Well, I understand this. I've always wondered exactly in which part of law this is a principle that applies. I know it's not a principle, for example, in criminal law, unless a fact is affirmatively proven or admitted to, it's not seen to be consented to, but it may be something else.
Well, now that's interesting, Mark, because in the play, Sir Thomas Cromwell tells the jury that, you know, if I take a knife and make to kill the prisoner and you remain silent, you are guilty as well as I, because your silence indicates consent. Is that not right?
Well, it's certainly not right in the sense of, let's say, complicity. Where something more than simply not doing anything is required in order to convict somebody, even as a second, even as an accomplice to the principle. So I've always wondered about this principle, but maybe, you know what, Mark, maybe in the past it was different. Maybe the evolution of the law of, let's say, complicity shows this kind of development from a harder rule with respect to not doing anything and the requirement that you sort of act like a good Samaritan to a more, again, liberal principle of autonomy, where if you just sort of sit there and do nothing, you are not considered to be involved at all in the crime.
So I don't know. Well, maybe we found a big hole in the plot of this film. I don't know. Well, I would say in contracts, you know, it's not never. It's sometimes silence can be assent and you will be taken to have agreed to an offer. But generally speaking, no. Anyway, that's what Thomas thinks. And he says, and let's just assume arguendo that he's right. If I'm just silent, then as a legal matter, they have to leave me alone. It turns out, however, and this is what Thomas finds out only at the very end, right? I mean, it's in the last 10 minutes of the film that he learns this. The law cannot protect you in a totalitarian regime like Henry's. You know, in other words, Thomas has a kind of naive faith in the law. That's his attitude. If I just follow the law, they will leave me alone. But of course, you can't count on the law alone. the law is administered by human beings. And if human beings are willing to lie, if they're willing to twist the law, if they're willing to ignore its requirements, then you're not safe. And that's actually what Thomas learns. Mark?
And that's true, I would think, also, perhaps, again, not in as extreme as an example as in a totalitarian state, but there are always limits beyond which the law cannot protect you, limits dealing with sort of fundamental issues that are sort of very, very important to the society. And so there are sort of different ways in which the sort of ultimate issues can put pressure on the protection that the law can give you, even in situations where it looks like the law ought to be on your side. I think that's true. That's true even in non-totalitarian regimes.
Yeah, and actually we should say, I mean, totalitarian, so people understand what we're talking about. You know, the difference between an authoritarian regime and a totalitarian regime is the following. I mean, an authoritarian regime would insist that dissenters remain silent, right? You know, they would prohibit you from speaking out in dissent. A totalitarian regime, by contrast, will insist that dissenters express support for the regime. It's not good enough to stay silent. That's what I mean by a totalitarian regime. They're not going to let you just quietly dissent. You actually have to make a public statement. Now, I guess, Mark, what you're saying is even in a situation in which we're not in a totalitarian state that we would think of one like, you know, communist Soviet Union or something, there still may be substantial pressure. Maybe there are social pressures. Maybe there are political pressures to actually express your agreement with the governing body or with controlling opinion. I think that's what you're saying, Mark.
I think that's right. Or at least not to remain silent, even if you're not actually compelled to say something. And I think there are cases, for example, in constitutional law, Barnett and others, involving issues of compelled speech. Now, of course, in the Supreme Court came to the defense of the people who were being compelled to speak, but that doesn't take away from the fact that the society, either by law or through various other sorts of pressures, was very interested in making dissenting voices say things, or at least not being quiet wasn't really enough, and there were either pressures to actually speak, or at the very least awkwardness and bad feeling on the part of folks who were upset that dissenters had the views that they had.
They did, although, look, I think, Mark, it's fair to say, I mean, you know, you mentioned that in Barnett, the Supreme Court said that the Jehovah's Witnesses could not be compelled to say something. And I should say, our listeners might be interested, that in contemporary human rights law, when it comes to freedom of conscience and freedom of religion, especially in Europe, they have two ideas which I think are good analytically. On the one hand, we have something called positive confessional freedom, and that means your freedom to state your beliefs, your religious beliefs in public and not be punished. And then they have a concept called negative confessional freedom, which is your ability to remain silent about your religious beliefs and not be forced to reveal them. And at least in contemporary human rights law in Europe, and I think also in the United States, Mark, we do have this negative confessional freedom. At least so far, the state cannot force you to reveal something if you want to remain silent about it.
That's true. There are contemporary analogs in all kinds of cases that we could think about, cases involving compelled expression through the operation of various civil rights laws and so on. Those, it seems to me, are live issues. But I think the more general concept of, take away the state, for example, of actually being punished, the more general concept of the application of pressure of various kinds to say or not to say something. And at least in terms of the context of representing clients, let's say, which is the context that we were dealing with, the compulsion or felt compulsion to say something or not say something, or otherwise you're going to suffer in your professional life, in your personal life, and so on. I do think that those kinds of examples do occur, where you can sort of think about the the news and social media, they can occur fairly commonly.
No, and this is one of the critiques of classical liberalism, which people are making now more and more, which is that, okay, classical liberalism says the state can't force you to speak, but maybe there are situations where your boss can try to force you to speak, in which case you may have some serious consequences, even if it's not the state that is meeting them out to you. I think that's a fair point.
Okay, that's exactly right. Yeah.
Okay, listeners. Well, thanks very much for listening to this. We'll draw that to a close. I hope, I'm sure Professor DiGirolami would join me in congratulating all the 1Ls at St. John's on finishing Intro to Law. We hope that this podcast will be useful for them. We hope it'll be interesting and useful for our other listeners as well. And we hope you'll join us in our next podcast when we'll return to current cases and issues. Meanwhile, for Mark DiGirolami, this is Mark Movsesian at the Center for Law and Religion at St. John's with another episode of Legal Spirits. See you next time.